This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The pandemic shut down the dance world, but if you want to see some remarkable dancing, check out the new PBS American Masters documentary about Twyla Tharp, one of the most celebrated dancers and choreographers of our time. New York Times dance critic Gia Corliss wrote, quote, "Twyla Tharp threw down a gauntlet in 1973. She mixed classical and modern dance to make the first crossover ballet, Deuce Coupe. It was a revolutionary work. Miss Tharp remains among the very few female choreographers to have had a lasting influence on ballet." Unquote. The music that Tharp used in Deuce Coupe was by the Beach Boys. That's an example of something else Tharp became famous for, choreographing to music by people as diverse as Haydn, Philip Glass, Big Spiderbeck, Sinatra, David Byrne, and Billy Joel. In 1976, she became the first choreographer to create a dance for Mikhail Baryshnikov, who had defected to the West from the Soviet Union in 1974. Her dance, Push Comes to Shove, required Baryshnikov to draw on his sublime classical technique and to do things that were totally contrary to his ballet training. Tharp's choreography demands incredible flexibility, speed, power, and stamina, and the ability to perform dances that draw from ballet, modern dance, jazz, tap, vaudeville, and everyday movement. Her work has been performed in every kind of venue, including on Broadway and in movies. She's won an Emmy and a Tony, has been a Kennedy Center honoree, and won a MacArthur Fellowship. The new documentary, Twyla Moves, is still playing on some PBS stations and is streaming on pbs.org. As you can see in the documentary, neither the pandemic nor her age, she's 79, has stopped her from choreographing. With everyone shut in, she choreographed a dance through Zoom with four different dancers at home in four different parts of the world. Twyla Tharp, welcome to Fresh Air. It is a pleasure to have you. The documentary is amazing, as is your dancing and choreography. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, your dances draw on all forms of dancing. And you studied, when you were a child, you studied ballet, you studied modern dance, I think you took tap lessons. What really inspired you when you were young? What kind of dance did you love the most?
Well, it wasn't simply dancing. And actually, I started with music training, both in piano and violin and percussion. And the dancing came after the fact. But on the other hand, my mother was a concert pianist. And as a very tiny child, baby, I was going to her classes. And so I was always, you know, wiggling, and then I could crawl, and then I could sort of hop. So I've always been dancing.
When you started dancing, you didn't have a stage. You weren't getting paid. So you and the dancers you worked with danced in the world instead of in a theater. What are some of the public places that you danced in?
Oh, Lord. Okay, well, the first concert was in a university. It was in the art department. It was in an exhibition space. We danced, as is in the film, on a rooftop that we managed to find somewhere. We danced in public spaces, amphitheaters that were, you know, not being used, parks, malls, subway platforms. If it, you know, basically was kind of level, it was fair territory. And how we did it, I'm not quite sure. I wouldn't ask a professional dancer to work on some of the surfaces that we didn't think twice about because very dangerous for sprains, strains, all the rest of it. But what did we know? So, yeah, uneven territory. That was our proven ground.
One of the things you're famous for is using all forms of music. Haydn, Philip Glass, Billy Joel, Sinatra, the Beach Boys. But when you started dancing, you sometimes didn't use music at all. Was that also about getting down to the very fundamentals of music? I mean, of movement?
Yeah, no. Thank you for confusing the two. That's very appropriate. As I said, when I was a child, I was trained in a number of musical disciplines. I played in string quartets. I played in bands, so that I had a sense of where music goes and how it functions, how it operates. And so when I worked for 5 years, not playing music when we performed, it was always in my head. We had always always heard it in rehearsal. We just didn't choose to show it or hear or perform it while we were dancing because I wanted to learn what does movement communicate. And music is much more comfortable for the general public than movement. You know, I often say, take one phrase of movement and put it on happy music. The audience thinks it's a happy dance. Put it on sad music and they'll think it's a sad dance and the movement is exactly the same. So I wanted to try to see what the emotional resonance of movement was, what excited people, caused them to be, what was provocative, what would they register, all of those, not all of those, but many visual questions were asked, and that wouldn't have been possible with music because music is so overpowering.
When you started your company, and this was in 1966, the company was all women. And why did you want it to be all women?
Well, let's see here. I think we knew there was a bias. I think we knew there was a bias in the world of art across the boards, whether it was music, painting, sculpture, literature, dance, and we wanted to fortify ourselves in such a way that we could put forth what we thought was our strongest suit. And our strongest suit was a lot of technique and a lot of incredible ensemble work, but also strong individual voices. And we didn't want the business of gender to get in the way of particularly the latter, that I was a very different force from Big Rose or from Sarah or from Teresa, that we all had singular qualities. And that was clearer if we were all women than had a man been in the group, we would have been the women, he would or they would have been the men. And that would have become the distinctive defining characteristic rather than the individual qualities of each human being.
And by having it be all women in your company, did it also help open the door to having different types of women? Because, you know, often in dance, like the choreographer or the head of the company has a certain type that they want. And certainly in ballet, you almost need to be physically a certain type. And you've even talked about like bringing somebody into your company who was rejected because they were too tall for the company they had auditioned for. So was this also a way of like opening the door to like different types of women, different body types, different heights?
Yeah, diversity. I've always, one of my favorite thematic modi is inclusive. In order to be inclusive, you need to have differentiation. So by having tall, short, classically trained, no classic training, great athlete, all of these various qualities would redefine and give a three-dimensional quality to the work that obviously is lacking if there is a body type that is featured throughout the ensemble. One understands that need of fungibility in professional companies because if one dancer goes out, they want to be able to put another one in as directly and efficiently as possible and hopefully in the same costume. It's all the bottom line, right? To me, that was not what dancing was about, and it still isn't.
In 1973, Robert Joffrey of the Joffrey Ballet asked you to choreograph a piece for his company. You've said about that working with the men, that some of the men just didn't want to be told what to do by a woman. How did you deal with that? You were so used to working with women.
It was simple. It was, okay, let's jump now. And I'm a very strong jumper, and I jumped higher, longer than most of the men. So it was like, okay, guys, let's go. That's how I've basically always been able to work with men, is through strength and by a kind of challenge. And, okay, put it on the line, let's go. But, you know, men can be very arrogant, and we all can. And it, when there is a position of, they knew perfectly well that they were getting away with a kind of bloody murder. And so they were not perhaps all that secure. And if they were given the opportunity to work around that bias, many of them would. And gratefully, I mean, you'll see some male dancers in Deuce Coupe, and even that raw footage, were doing kind of extraordinary things. I think they were glad to be asked to work in a different way. Eventually, it took a little doing, perhaps. But
right.
And some of them, a couple, never came round, but that's okay.
You wrote a dance for Mikhail Baryshnikov a couple of years after he defected to the West. And at the time, he was really like the most famous dancer. And you say you had to teach him to slouch, which of course goes against ballet training. Mm. And he was, you know, classically trained in Russia. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, superb, you know, ballet dancer. What is the importance of slouch in your dance? And what did it take to help him learn how to slouch, which probably really went against his instincts as a dancer?
No, because East Europeans always wanted to be cool. And being cool meant hanging down. So while he didn't quite know how to do it, it was certainly something that was seductive. And so, you know, you get your weight back a little on the heel. There were certain things like syncopated movements that he had not been trained in. And when he'd start to do it, it was like you'd look at him and your heart goes out to him, because here's this great dancer and he's trying something that is that unfamiliar and uncomfortable. And he mastered it. He got it. He figured it out. He watched it. He felt it. He wanted to do it. He came here to dance differently.
And what was the importance of slouching?
Again, community. How many people sitting out there in your audience have the placement of a great classical dancer? So, of course, they're going to feel distance from a great classical dancer if that great classical dancer never for a moment kind of goes down and is a little bit like you, and you can feel their rhythms, you can feel them breathing. Then they can go into that higher upper sphere and you can exalt with them. You're not intimidated by them. That's why it's a slouch.
You work your dancers really hard, but are you always confident that they can do what you're asking them to do? Do you worry about causing an injury?
Let me interrupt, because I don't think it's quite fair to say I work them hard. I give them challenges, which they take up on their own, because a great dancer wants to be challenged. They want to be pushed. They want to evolve. I'm very careful about injury.
You became a mother in your late 20s, and you and your son in the documentary talk a little bit about how you were so absorbed in your dancing and in keeping your company afloat and in touring with your company and performing. It didn't leave that much time for him. And I'm trying to ask this next question without being misunderstood, because I'm afraid it's going to come off sounding like a criticism, which it is not meant to be. So with that preface, I will ask you the question. When you were growing up, your mother, you say she drove like hundreds of miles a week sometimes just to take you to all the classes that she wanted to take you to for, like, you know, dance and music and all the stuff that you were doing, because she exposed you to so much. And look at the results. I mean, you know, that certainly worked. But it sounds like you were kind of, you couldn't do that for your son because you were so busy with your own career and keeping a company afloat. Like, you had people you were responsible for, you know, professionally too. And I guess, did you often go through like comparing yourself and your mother as mothers?
One of the things I did not want to do was to take away my son's childhood. I had no childhood. I was trained from the time I was 6 months old to become something, as I say in the picture. And I never had time to ask the question, what do I want to do? I was busy doing, and I always did, my assignments of many different sorts. I wanted him to have choices. We were a very different kind of parenting style.
Yeah, you say in the documentary that your mother gave you lessons in dance and music, shorthand, German, French, and everything except how to live. Uh-huh. So when you say she gave you lessons in everything except how to live, What else do you feel like you didn't learn that other children your age did learn?
Basically, how to communicate with peers, with other folk. I was a very silent child. I learned not a lot about the ordinary sustaining of life. For example, I still can't cook, which is a real shortcoming. But food was not really thought of as anything other than hurry up, let's get going. And the pleasures of life were not something that we considered. It was work and lessons, right? It's just different. And one needs to be grateful for what one had, which is an enormous amount, not what one didn't have. But when it comes time for giving the opportunity of evolving to another person, that which you feel lacking in your own upbringing, you want to make available to your offspring, right?
Was your drive to keep dancing and go to every possible class, was that your mother's drive or your drive when you were young?
No, by the time I got to college, it was my drive. When I was a kid, she had determined that I should better study everything, A, because she herself was very eclectic. She herself was very democratic. She herself we came from dirt farmers in the Midwest, right? Mules pulling equipment. And she always wanted to be able to expand that in every possible direction. She didn't judge. She didn't judge that popular music was better or not as good as Bach. They were different.
When you talk about mules pulling equipment, was that your mother's experience, or did you grow up with that too when you were living in Indiana before moving to California?
When my mother was, she had twins, and she had a fourth child, another child 2 days, 3 days before the twins were a year old. So during that period of time, when essentially she had triplets, I was put on her parents' farms. Those farms were, there was no electricity, there were kerosene farms, and there were no phones, and there was no running water in the house. So they were very, very basic, and I'm very grateful for those 4 or 5 years that I experienced that kind of fundamental existence.
In your memoir, Keep It Moving, you wrote about all the stamina you had when you were in your 20s and how your movement and stamina changed over the decades. And you write, in your 20s, flexibility, yeah. Speed was a specialty. Power, actually not as great as it would become later. My coordination let me flip movement in space, over, under, forward, back, torso going counter or parallel to the hips. Isolations were honed to where I could deliver movement off a single muscle. I was a big jumper. My falls were fearless. Balance was always my weakness, but you would never know that.
Mm-mm.
Eating was anything, anytime. So as you approach 80, where are you now in terms of what you feel like your body's capable of?
Okay, that's a fair question. And the answer is I'm not quite sure, because this last year has been so compromised. Both by the pandemic, but also by the amount of work I've done, because not only was it the PBS show and for projects, I also just finished a 40-minute ballet that was done on 17 dancers, double zoomed. I was rehearsing 2 studios simultaneously. I had 4 assistants. And that one was done in Germany, which meant a huge time shift and was extraordinarily difficult. And I'm jet lagged, or I'm getting over the jet lag. So this last year, with the pandemic and its disruptions in terms of, routine, discipline, just ordinary day-to-day activities, the body doesn't know itself at the moment. So I can't tell you what I can ask it to do until I re-familiarize myself. And I'm in the process of doing that. I have, because I've done a number of gigging kinds of works, whether it's a film, which can take a year, or a Broadway show, which also is another year, during those periods of time, I've let myself go, because you don't have enough hours in the day to maintain the discipline the way I do when I'm not working on another project, and that project becomes primary. When I commit to doing a project, I commit to doing it completely, not with what's left over in terms of time. That means whenever I finished one of these big projects, I'm out of shape. So I've been in this position before, not at this age, but I know that it is a commitment to get back into shape.
Since you've been working with dancers through Zoom and showing them the choreography through Zoom, what are some of the biggest challenges been working like that? I know one of them is the delay, because we talked a little bit about this before we started the interview, because we have to deal with this when we're working long distance at home with our audio apps. And I know you were, I know that was a big source of frustration for you on Zoom.
Right. That is the biggest issue. The other was time. I mean, at one point I was rehearsing a dancer simultaneously on a unison phrase. One dancer was in New York at noon. One dancer was on the West Coast before breakfast. One dancer was in Denmark 5 hours ahead. And one dancer was in St. Petersburg working through their dinner hour. And we're all doing the same Zoom session. We're using the same phrase of movement. Good luck with that.
Good luck trying to coordinate all of that and make, you know, when you want something to be synchronized.
But that was the point, because nothing was capable of keeping us from having community. And that's what dance can give. Dance can give community.
Twyla Tharp, it's just been great to talk with you. And I really want to thank you for doing this.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And you obviously know what you're doing in this trade. And it's, you know, it's an honor to speak with you and be able to, you know, share in that experience that you bring. Thank you.
The PBS American Masters documentary about Twyla Tharp, called Twyla Moves, was recently broadcast on most PBS stations. You can still see it on some stations, but you can also stream it on pbs.org. The late Philadelphia pianist and composer Hassan Ibn Ali recorded only two albums. The first was a celebrated 1964 session titled The Max Roach Trio, featuring the legendary Hassan. The following year, he recorded a quartet date that went unreleased and was long believed lost. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says its rediscovery is cause for renewed celebration.
Jazz folk can be quick to compare any eccentric composer-pianist to Thelonious Monk. With Hassan Ibn Ali, the comparison is less misplaced than usual. His compositions and his quartet's rhythm have a similarly jaunty quality. But Hassan doesn't sound like Monk at the piano. His solos have their own hectic quality, with lots of busy runs near the top of the keyboard. That's from the tune Atlantic Ones, from pianist Hassan Ibn Ali's newly unearthed 1965 album, Metaphysics, The Lost Atlantic Session, now out on Omnivore. Hassan had a knack for writing memorable tunes like Viceroy. Its main earworm is pinched from an old Viceroy cigarette jingle, but Hassan adds some catchy phrases of his own. On tenor saxophone is another Philadelphian, later a longtime member of Max Roach's quartet, Odin Pope, making his recording debut at 22. Pope obviously dug Philly hero John Coltrane, but he had a ruder, more obstreperous tone. He's still with us, by the way. Like the leader, Odin Pope might sound orderly and hectic by turns. Hassan Ibn Ali was sure of himself. At sessions, he'd push other pianists off the bench to take over. Still, horn players might walk off the bandstand when Hassan sat in, unwilling or unable to follow his concepts. Hassan's busy right-hand runs remind me of another lightning bolt pianist who came along in the mid-60s, Don Pullen. There are a couple of takes of three pieces on metaphysics, so we can hear how the soloists employ certain motifs at certain points from take to take, even as they improvise the particulars. The quartet's push-pull rhythm team keeps a loose rein on the proceedings. Drummer Khalil Mahdi was usually heard in more mainstream settings. Ditto the holdover from the previous year's LP, the Max Roach Trio featuring the legendary Hassan, bass virtuoso Art Davis. So the question remains, why did Atlantic not release this vibrant, tuneful 1965 session at the time? It may have had something to do with a slightly out-of-tune piano, but more to do with the fact Hassan Ibn Ali was jailed on drug charges shortly thereafter. Thus, he was unable to promote the album on live appearances and created an awkward public relations problem for his respectable label. Sadly, Metaphysics was Hassan Ibn Ali's last shot at the big time. He never recorded again and died in obscurity in 1981.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed Metaphysics, the Lost Atlantic Session by pianist and composer Hassan Ibn Ali. My guest, Henry Louis Gates, has written a new book called The Black Church that's a companion to the PBS series he hosts of the same name. The book explores the history of African-American religions from the days of the transatlantic slave trade to the Black Lives Matter movement. He says black churches were the first institutions built by black people and run independent of white society in the U.S., with the earliest black Christian congregations roughly contemporaneous with the Declaration of Independence. He describes how churches became the foundation of black religious, political, economic, and social life. He also tells his story about the bargain he made with Jesus that led him to the church at age 12. But life eventually led him to become more of an observer than participant in religion. Henry Louis Gates has hosted many PBS series and written companion books exploring the history of African Americans, including the recent book and series on Reconstruction. He also hosts the series Finding Your Roots, in which through DNA tests and in-depth genealogical research, he reveals the ancestral history of his well-known guests. Gates is a professor at Harvard, where he directs the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research. Our interview was recorded last Thursday. Henry Louis Gates, welcome back to Fresh Air. A pleasure to have you back on our show. In the acknowledgments in your book, you thank a list of people for helping you fully realize the awesome significance of the Black church and Black religious beliefs in your own life and in the lives of other people. Let's talk a little bit about your own life. When you were young, your mother was Methodist, your father Episcopalian. You attended your mother's church as a child. Would you describe that church?
Yeah, it was a small Methodist church. It's called Walden Methodist Church. It's still there. And many of my cousins and old friends still worship at that church. And many of the people most dear to me who passed away are memorialized on the walls of the church. But it was a Methodist church, but it was almost a fundamentalist church. If you joined that church, you couldn't dance, you couldn't play cards, you couldn't go to basketball games, you couldn't go to movies. Obviously, you couldn't drink. You had to be faithful to your spouse. You know, it was very strict. It was almost like a Pentecostal church without the shouting and the speaking in tongues. And I joined that church when I was 12 years old.
There's a story behind why you joined the church. And your mother got sick. Your father was taking her to the hospital. But before he took her, she spoke to you. What did she tell you?
Well, it was a Sunday night, and I was playing on the floor and watching TV on our little 12-inch black and white TV. It's 1962. And my mom and dad were all dressed up, and it was Sunday evening, and I couldn't figure out why. And Mama had tears in her eyes, and she bent over, and she said, "Skippy, I have to tell you something. We're going to the hospital, and I'm going to die. I've been very sick, and I'm going to die, and I'm saying goodbye, and I want you to be good to your father, and you listen to him." And I looked, and I just burst into tears, I mean, hysterically. And she cried, and she hugged me, and my father took her arm, and they walked out the door. And I just, I was stunned in tears. I just didn't know what to do. I went upstairs to my bedroom, and I got on my knees, and I was weeping hysterically, and I prayed to Jesus. And I said, "If you let my mother live, I will give my life to you, to Christ." And I don't remember much else about that, except I prayed over and over, and I cried myself to sleep. And finally, you know, 3 days later, my mother came home from the hospital, and it was a miracle. She hadn't died. And I looked in the mirror and I said, "Uh-oh." You know, you don't mess with God. You know, I made a deal with Jesus. So unbeknownst to anybody, I hitchhiked 5 miles to Kaiser for the Saturday afternoon service. I didn't tell anybody. And I went into the church. There were probably about 12 people there gathered for the service. Their average age must have been 80. And they all thought it was sort of cute. Everybody knew everybody, you know, in the hills of West Virginia, in the colored community, as we put it. And there's a point in the service called the call to the altar. And when the minister says, "Anybody here like to give their life to Christ?" And I stood up. And the minister innocently thought that I had stood up to go to the bathroom. And he said, "Skippy, the toilet is right back here." And I said, "No, I want to join the church." And he gasped, and everybody's eyes got big, and they all stood up. He invited me to the altar. Everybody in the church gathered around me, and he read the questions that they posed to a would-be convert, and I answered, "Yes, I would," or I answered affirmatively. And it was very moving. It was, I cried, the people all cried, and they hugged me. And so I was a member of the church.
A lot of people make bargains with God. Like, if I get better, if I heal, I will devote my life to you. So many people make that bargain and don't keep it. Why did you keep it? Like, what motivated you to take it that seriously and actually follow through?
I wanted my mother to live, and I was convinced that Jesus had performed a miracle. Let My Mother Live. And the price was that I would join the church. The exchange was that I would give my life to Christ.
Wait, so did you think that you saved your mother's life, that your prayer saved her life?
Well, I wasn't arrogant enough to think that necessarily, but I know that I had made a promise to God, and that if my mother lived, I would give my life to Christ. So Terry, for 2 years, I didn't go to basketball games, and I was the only sport that we had at our school. I didn't play cards. I loved playing cards. That was a way of life in my household. Pinochle, canasta, hearts, spades, the bid whist. I didn't dance. I loved to dance. And remember, it's 62, so it was R&B, and the soul music was about to burst out, Motown. I didn't do any of those things. I went to church. I joined the choir. And finally, my brother, I have one brother who's 5 years older, Dr. Paul Gates. He was in dental school, and he was worried about my mental health. And he said, I've had enough of this. He came home from West Virginia University Dental School, and he said, I'm taking you to see the new Beatles movie. It's 1964. And he put me in his Corvair car and dragged me to the mall, and I went in, and I watched this Beatles movie, and it gave me so much pleasure. But when I came out of the movie, I was terrified. I thought a bolted lightning was going to come out of the sky and strike me dead. And right after that, I'm, you know, never really lived up to all the ideals that a convert should live up to, but I did my best. And it's all I could do, Terry. I mean, your mother's going to die. My mother was my hero. She was the most brilliant, beautiful person I have ever met. She taught me herself to read and write. This is long before Sesame Street. We used to watch Ding Dong School.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Arlene Francis.
Yes, with Miss Francis, precisely. And we would read and, you know, make the letters. And I learned cursive, though we didn't call it cursive then. We just called it writing. And we would make paper mache castles. And by the time I hit first grade, I was light years ahead of all the other kids. It was because of my mother. We were very close. I look like my mother. We were very, very close. And the idea that she was going to die was just unbearable to me. And so I owed that sacrifice to protect my mother's life.
Part of your new book was written during the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter protests and the ongoing fight for voting rights. Churches were closed or partially closed by the pandemic, but the role of church leaders in, for example, fighting for voting rights continues. When you were writing this book, what's an example of like a through line that you saw where you felt the church's activism was like, here we go again? Like everything changes, nothing changes.
Well, we tend to forget that Black politics fighting anti-Black racism was born in the church. Frederick Douglass, the most famous of all the Black abolitionists, learned to speak from the pulpit of the AME Zion Church in New Bedford, Massachusetts, between 1838 and 1841, before he made his famous speech at the meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society on Nantucket in 1841. Three of the 16 Black men elected to Congress in Reconstruction were ministers. Before Martin Luther King emerged in the South in 1955, the face of the civil rights movement was Adam Clayton Powell Jr., as you know, who was a minister, as his father was, of Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. And he was a minister elected to Congress. And then Martin Luther King, Andy Young, for a Black mayor of Atlanta, was a minister, and John Lewis himself was an ordained minister. So the history of Black politics is coterminous with the history of the African-American church. And we see that most recently in the miraculous election of Reverend Raphael Warnock, who is the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, which was Martin Luther King's church, and his father, Daddy King's church. So the tradition continues.
The church has always been important in getting out the vote. Can you talk a little bit about like the souls to the polls role of the church and how voter suppression has tried to limit the church's ability to get people to the polls?
Well, we could look at two examples. Everyone forgets that when Joe Biden came out of New Hampshire, virtually nobody but Joe thought he was going to get the nomination. And Representative Jim Clyburn hit that magic black button, which is called the Network of the Black Churches, when Joe Biden came into South Carolina. They mobilized, and Biden was successful, and that changed the whole dynamic of the primaries. And then the miracle in Georgia, under the direction of Stacey Abrams, which led to the election to the Senate of Reverend Raphael Warnock, was fundamentally dependent on souls to the polls, particularly the role of African-American women, which has always been crucial in the black church. So I'm very proud of the way that the church responded to this challenge, because our people faced a crisis. And four more years of Donald Trump, as epitomized by the insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th, would have been as disastrous to the rights of African-American people as was the rollback to Reconstruction in the period called Redemption and the Lost Cause movement.
One of the great contributions of black churches is gospel music. And I had asked you to choose a gospel song that you particularly love, that means something to you. And you chose a song by Mahalia Jackson, sung by Mahalia Jackson, called Walk in Jerusalem. And I'd like you to talk about why you chose this song, and also about her importance, not just as a singer, but as somebody who really contributed to the civil rights movement.
I chose Mahalia Jackson because my father loved Mahalia Jackson, despite the fact that he was an Episcopalian. The music he loved was black gospel music. And among all black gospel musicians, among all black gospel singers, he thought Mahalia Jackson was the queen. And of all of her many, many masterpieces, Walking in Jerusalem was his favorite. And she used to appear on the Ed Sullivan Show. That's when I first saw her when I was a kid. Going to walk in Jerusalem, talk in Jerusalem. You know, it's just infectious. And you know that for her, Jerusalem was a place where you found eternal life, but it also was a place beyond racism. And she played a pivotal role in the civil rights movement. She was Martin Luther King's personal spiritual advisor. When Martin Luther King would have a spiritual crisis, as we all do, he would call Mahalia Jackson in the middle of the night. He'd wake her up and say, Mahalia, I'm suffering, I'm having a hard time. And she would sing one of his favorite songs. His favorite was Precious Lord, Take My Hand, which had been composed by Thomas A. Dorsey.
You know, Mahalia Jackson, in addition to singing on the phone to Martin Luther King when he needed spiritual or you know, just emotional support, she helped fund him when he traveled. She helped fund the Freedom Riders.
Oh, absolutely. She, like Harry Belafonte, was a blank check for the movement. If Martin asked her, she wrote the check. And so that shows another level of complexity of the relationship between the black church, as it were, in this case, a member of the black church and a musician in the black church, with the politics affecting the larger black community. And that role needs to be told. Oh, and one of the most important things she did was when Dr. King was giving the I Have a Dream speech, he didn't intend to use the phrase, I have a dream, which he got from Prathia Hall, as we say in this series and in the book. Prathia Hall used it in the sermon. She drove him to the airport, and he turned her and said, Prathia, I like that phrase. You don't mind if I use it? She said, no, I'll be flattered. And of course, it's identified with him, but its origin is with a black woman. So he's on the stage in front of all those people on the mall, and he's giving his speech, which was okay. And Mahalia, who has an impeccable sense of timing, says, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. Remember, she's sitting right behind him. Tell him about the dream, Martin. And so he shifted gears totally in an improvisatory way, and gives the I Have a Dream speech, which he had given many, many times on the road and in his own church. And it turned into one of the two greatest speeches/sermons, I think, in American history. The other, of course, is I've Been to the Mountaintop, which he gave at the Charles Harrison Mason Temple. He was the founder of the Church of God in Christ in Memphis on that night before he was so brutally slain in 1968.
Well, before we hear Mahalia Jackson, I want to thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air. It's been a pleasure to talk with you again.
Oh, thank you. You took me, you lifted me higher.